This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm delighted to have on the program Ned Blackhawk, Associate Professor of History and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Ned Blackhawk's the author of a fascinating new book entitled Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empire in the Early American West. Ned Blackhawk, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
You write in your epilogue about the need to overcome caricatures of the American Indian. As you put it, the square pegs of Indian experiences so rarely fit into the circular holes of received knowledge. What are some of those circular holes?
Well, this book is really an attempt to give deeper meaning to the experiences of American Indians in our nation's past. And many people are familiar with Indians as icons and as emblems of America in general, but often lack the particular specific knowledge of individual American Indian communities or nations, giving historical breadth to particularly the Ute, Paiute, and Shoshone tribal histories is really the primary goal here.
Why do you focus on the Great Basin area and the Indian tribes there?
Out of both intellectual and personal reasons, my family is from the Great Basin, the central parts of Nevada. And I've grown up away from the region for most of my life and feel deeply interested in both learning more about our own family's past, but also countering a whole host of intellectual and academic frames that have positioned these Indian peoples, those largely without horses, those Paiute and Shoshone groups that I referenced, posited these non-equestrian peoples as among the most primitive peoples of the world.
You know, I was horrified, Ned Blackhawk, to find one of my heroes fallen, Mark Twain, who I've always liked and I've admired not only for Huckleberry Finn and for fighting racism, but for fighting imperialism in the Philippines and being vice president of the Anti-Imperial League, and then to come upon the horrible racist depictions he had of the Shoshone really took me back.
Well, Twain really emblematizes many of the dominant visions of these non-equestrian peoples, and it's surprising to find not only Twain but many other prominent 19th century Americans like Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, Brigham Young, Christopher Kit Carson circulating throughout a region that is often portrayed without history. Twain's anti-imperialism is something that develops later in his life, and he is positioned first as a Western American writer during his stints in Nevada during the 1860s. He subsequently moves to California, where he really begins gaining larger national and regional attention, subsequently then goes to Hawaii, where he concludes the first the end portions of his first novel, Roughing It.
You know, I knew he'd gone to Nevada, and I thought it was just kind of happenstance, but I didn't realize his brother was the governor or the appointed governor of Nevada.
He's appointed secretary of Nevada by Lincoln's administration, and his younger brother Samuel comes with him across the continent, as many 19th century Americans did, venturing into these unfamiliar territories to many English speakers. And he witnesses Indian peoples who are often struggling to survive, and he interprets their impoverishment as signs of inferiority. And it's those types of caricatures that I'm really trying to counter here.
And the crucial question then is, why were they struggling to survive?
Well, that's really the bulk of the study, and the concluding part is at the end, where Twain and other American territorial leaders arrive in the region, and they witness things that often shock and horrify them, not only the deep impoverishment that characterizes the native experiences of this region, but also particularly violent and horrific forms of enslavement, captivity, and just general lawlessness. And it's these themes of violence that really organize the study and led me to excavate basically two centuries of pre-U.S. territorial history in the region, leading me into places like the Spanish Archives of New Mexico and other realms.
Was that a fun archaeological dig?
Archival excavation, it was. And Santa Fe is one of the most beautiful and I think underappreciated places in North America. And having an opportunity to live there was really quite an honor and privilege. But it's really fascinating to see so many Indian histories outside of the narrative of American history take flight in both archival and also limited scholarly realms. There are centuries of interactions between these native peoples and imperial powers, particularly Spain, England, and later the United States, that generally don't fall into the purview of most American historians. Recentering the kind of teleological vision of American history that proceeds from east to west is really one of the primary objectives here, and bringing Indians and empires that are previously under recognized to the forefront of analysis is one of the intentions.
Ned Blackhawk, you make violence a central theme of this book, and you say before the impact of European colonization, either the Spanish colonization in the West or the English colonization in the eastern part of the United States, that violence was a localized thing for the Indians that you were studying, and then the violence took on a different form after the impact of this encounter.
That's one of the most important scholarly revelations of the past generation in the study of early American history, is that the realms outside of the immediate spheres of European colonization also have histories that are linked, obviously, to the imperial histories of Europe. And accessing and understanding those histories has become both a fascinating as well as challenging endeavor. These regions become accelerated in many ways by the arrival of European technologies, diseases, and various influences, particularly the influence to become a part of the economic and political world of imperial or colonial America. And scholars and students and teachers of American history often struggle to really make sense of this chaotic and traumatic world in which violence becomes a necessary form of survival. Those are the subjects that really link and organize the study and also tie into these larger scholarly transformations that are occurring. People may be familiar with the insights of Jared Diamond or lately Charles Mann's book, 1491, that have uncovered the tremendous diversity and sophistication of pre-Columbian North American and Latin American Native populations, but we haven't fully gotten a grasp of how disruptive and traumatic the arrival of many European influences have been on Native peoples throughout the American continent outside of those direct spheres of influence. So peoples throughout much of the American continent find themselves engulfed in chaotic and traumatic worlds long before actual agents of empire arrive. So there's a chapter in the book about Lewis and Clark, for example, venturing west of the Missouri headwaters in 1805 and encountering Indian peoples who are struggling with these multiple imperial influences. So we should view these earliest Euro-American explorers not as agents moving into undiscovered or uninfluenced worlds, but as peoples entering into already impacted societies.
And they were impacted by Spain.
Initially, Spain is the first imperial power in North America, despite so many perhaps perspectives to the contrary. Spain crisscrosses the American Southwest and Southeast generations before the founding of both Jamestown and Plymouth Colony, and sets in motion the necessary and requisite conditions for the subsequent creation of other imperial powers. It's not coincidental that England chooses Virginia and later New England as the sites of their earliest colonies in North America, because Spain has both left those regions incorporated into their empire and also has radically disrupted those native societies.
And it's not as though the native societies in the West simply rolled over for the Spaniards.
No, and that's really the other, or one of the other major revelations of the past generation of historical scholars of early America. The capacity of Indian peoples to really shape and impact and determine, in many cases, the histories of our nation's earliest centuries has gone underrecognized until recently. And there are ample evidences throughout the first half of this book about particularly the equestrian youth societies of New Mexico and Colorado radically determining and influencing the composition of the Spanish borderlands of the Southwest.
So this goes against the theory of passivity or victimization.
Both passivity, victimization on the one hand, as well as ahistorical or timelessness on the other. And these are the stereotypes, the common tropes that many of your listeners may be familiar when they think about Indians. They may think of Indians in very kind of naturalized, romantic, or timeless ways.
That's noble savage kind of things.
Noble savagery or barbaric savagery are often identified as the two most quintessential characterizations of Indians that both are obviously simplified and unhelpful, because if we were going to really inhabit a multicultural a world, we have to recognize the diversity and humanity of all of our citizens.
And give some agency to people, too, which would be nice.
Likewise.
The brutality of the Spaniards surprises me, though. I've been to the Pueblo reservation there up at Taos and read about some of it, but I didn't know the story that you have in this book about holding up the Spaniards holding up some of the, I believe it was Pueblos, and chopping their feet off in front of people.
That's right. Spain is a violent empire, like all empires are, and they must monopolize the use of violence in their colonial worlds. Scholars and students and teachers of American history often also fail to recognize fully that the oldest permanently inhabited communities on the American continent, North American continent, are Pueblo Indian communities, particularly at places like Acoma and Taos that you mentioned in Isleta and the multiple Pueblos along the northern Rio Grande, have inhabited the northern New Mexican landscape for generations before the arrival of Spaniards in the 1530s. So we're talking about a history that goes far back into the pre-Columbian time period, and one that has been incorporated into European imperial zones for now over four centuries. And we often don't think of our country's past as dating back that many centuries to the first imperial powers in North America, but they do. And they obviously leave legacies that many peoples are still grappling with, including the forms of brutality that the Spanish conquistadors initiate in the 1590s.
One startling thing also, Ned Blackhawk, who's the author of Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West, is when the settlers, colonizers from the East, ultimately, you know, around the period of the Civil War, the decades before and the decades after, when they come west, just how, not only how brutal, but how fast it is. Because you talk about changes, a whole culture essentially annihilated, conquered, a way of life destroyed within a generation. And I think we forget that, at least I had forgotten that, in my memory of you know, the frontier and the westward ho and all that stuff. Because to me, it seemed like, well, it was going to go, it's going on and on and on. But people's lives just literally changed in a generation. What kind of a psychic impact does that have?
Well, it's particularly felt most destructively by equestrian communities whose livelihoods are revolve around, obviously, equestrian subsistence and buffalo or bison economies. And Colorado really provides a really interesting window into this 19th century past, because you have, on the one hand, the equestrian societies whose societies are annihilated in an economic form. There are cultural, obviously, and religious and social institutions that do survive the aftermath of conquest and reservation confinement, though Colorado's plains will be nearly fully emptied of Indians during the 1860s, culminating in the horrific massacre at Sand Creek in November of 1864 during the Civil War. And there's some study of that in the sixth chapter of this book. On the other hand, you do have all these mountain Indians, particularly the Ute Indians that I focus on, who now inhabit two reservations in southwestern Colorado, though they once, and you won't believe me when I tell you this, they once obtained a reservation that covers nearly an entire third of Western Colorado. And their subsequent loss and dispossession of this once vast reservation homeland is something very, very few Western historians have dealt adequately with.
You know, I hadn't read about that until I read your book, Ned Blackhawk, and also I hadn't understood or appreciated certainly the diplomatic skill that they employed to acquire that reservation and to withstand some of the onslaught.
The Utes of Colorado and northern New Mexico appear in out of focus in most histories of this region, yet they have some of the most brilliant statesmen of all 19th century American Indian leaders, particularly a young shepherd from northern New Mexico named Ouray, after whom a town in western Colorado is named. Ouray helps inaugurate, as I mentioned, a 15-million-acre reservation that gets senatorial ratification in 1868. We all understand what the United States Senate represents in our own governing system, but often fail to recognize that the Senate has been historically the primary domain for adjudicating Indian treaties with the nation's native communities set in motion by the Articles of the Constitution and upheld by Supreme Court rulings throughout the 19th century. Ouray's diplomatic achievement seems to represent generations of Ute struggles for survival. And so we have in this one state of our union, on the one hand, Indians on the plains who have been obliterated by U.S. cavalry forces during the U.S. Civil War, removed to distant reservations, sometimes in Oklahoma, northern or to the northern plains. While in the mountains, we have almost the obverse pattern, and this gets to the heart of the complications and the complexities that really attend to the study of our nation's native past. So when we think about Indians, we do have to think in often tribally specific and regionally specific ways.
What happened to that one-third of Colorado that was supposed to be a reservation?
Well, it was for 12 years or so, and that was that ends that chapter in many ways. It culminates the end of the book, because the book really studies the two centuries beforehand that examined the history of Indians before reservations are created throughout this vast part of North America. Ouray dies in his last days trying to withstand the culminating forces of dispossession that ultimately deprive this once vast Indian homeland from the Ute peoples of western Colorado, many of whom will be forced to migrate into the Uintah Basin of eastern Utah, where they will join other dispossessed Ute Indians on what becomes known as the UNO, or the Uintah-Ouray Reservation of Utah.
Now, were they forced out by policies and actions of the federal government, or were there other things that
It was mainly regional and territorial interests that culminated in the abrogation of this Senate treaty, as most Colorado settlers were unable to, as many state settlers were often in the 19th century, to uphold the nation's national Indian policies. And this is really the tragedy of American Indian diplomacy for the 19th century. Is not only are Indian peoples pushed, removed, often obliterated by the U.S. Army, but even those in that agreements that the U.S. government enters into, are, those agreements are often not upheld by other citizens of the United States, particularly states and territories in Western areas. And this is one of the most important things, I think, to understand about our nation's Indian past, is that the federal government, despite its often terrible and tragic and ill-conceived policies towards our nation's Indian peoples, still remains the primary arbiter of Indian policy. And so despite many state legislatures or counties throughout the states, despite many of their own preferences to try to deal with Indians, these matters are really of a federal nature that need often federal guarantees and secures because...
So it wasn't so much the federal government reneging on its promises, but they were just not obeyed.
That's right.
By the white power structures.
And once minerals and resources are found within reservation boundaries, it becomes a very common tale, as many of your listeners may know, in places like South Dakota, where very large reservations once established for Indian peoples become rapidly overrun by miners and settlers and prospectors who have limited or if not any intentions of following the nation's Indian policies.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Ned Blackhawk, author of Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West. I know I've learned a lot about that period and the different tribes and different experiences. So I think it's a fascinating book. Can we bring it forward a little toward today? You talk about the ascendancy of contemporary American Indian people, the dawn even of a new era. What are you referring to?
I'm referring to the rapidly changing historical currents in which we all now find ourselves. Very few people, at least when I was growing up, really had any understanding of what contemporary American Indian experiences were like, non-Indians, that is. Now I think most people throughout the nation have a sense that there are still Native peoples within, obviously, our territory's limits, and that these communities have obtained often not well understood, but have obtained unprecedented degrees of at least economic and by extension, political influence over the past 15 or 20 years, emanating from particularly Indian gaming.
Casino, and some good judicial decisions, too.
That, too. We here in Wisconsin are familiar with the attempt by the Menominee Nation to restore their lost federal trust status during the termination era of the 1950s and 60s and celebrate that as often as we can. That post World War II anti-assimilation era has inaugurated a recent ascendancy of self-determination and sovereignty that is really unprecedented in our nation's past. Not really since, at any point since our nation's founding, have Indian peoples within the limits of the United States government had these degrees of economic and political influence. That influence, however, is not strictly tied to gaming, but is part of this longer history and struggle for survival that I don't really narrate here, but just reference. And many of your readers would be well served if interested in seeking out a wonderful and remarkable overview of this period by Colorado's law professor Charles Wilkinson's study, Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations. That volume, which I reference in my book, is the single most important study of this period, I think, to ever be authored. And it and other studies help demonstrate this revolution that has really occurred amongst our midst, because Indians 15, 20, 30 years ago were almost synonyms in many Western states, in particular, with pathology. Reservation communities were seen as mismanaged laboratories of waste and racist policies, but now have become remarkable and often flourishing homelands for our nation's original and first peoples. Here in Wisconsin, for example, the Oneida Nation of Green Bay was literally on the verge of disappearance 100 years ago when they celebrated in 1922 their centennial migration to eastern Wisconsin. They, at the time, had suffered tremendous reservation land loss, economic impoverishment, all kinds of outward migration, and just often tireless impoverishment. Those have been reversed. And the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, as you probably know and many of your listeners here would recognize, have become among the most profitable townships here in the state. They regularly employ thousands of both tribal and non-tribal members, and have become a lucrative and economic force in the region. And one of my favorite images is their constant advertisement within Lambeau Field. And you may see large billboards both at Lambeau and now in Miller Park, of our nation, of our state's Indian tribes, both the Oneida and now Potawatomi, regularly help support these public venues. So we're living in the midst of a radically transformed period in our nation's Indian past that many people have a hard time fully recognizing.
Another thing that people have a hard time recognizing or appreciating is in the academy the need for multicultural studies and multicultural history, which has been under attack from the right wing over the last many years. You talk about the contest for reconciliation, how important that is, and that's an intellectual contest, really. And you, why is that important?
Well, if we as American citizens are not fully informed of our nation's past, I think we're going to have a hard time reconciling the many divergent but ultimately unifying strands of our nation's past, because Indians and our nation's Indian past tell us a lot about our nation. They tell us about many of our nation's darkest chapters, and recently, as I was referring to, I think ultimately of our greatest glories. And bringing Indians into the narrative of America, I think, helps all of us hopefully deepen our appreciations of the multiple forms of American freedom as well as hardship that many of us have had to endure.
You write that it's possible, if we have this reckoning, this reconciliation, this comprehension that leads to reconciliation, that may also lead to not only coexistence, but you hold out the hope for redemption. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's really imperative and difficult for not only, I think, all of us to recognize each other's divergent and linked histories, but also to forgive one another. And both Native peoples and, in many cases, non-Native peoples often have a hard time grappling with those forms of redemption or forgiveness. And we have a chance and opportunity to look into the past to see ways of potentially moving forward together into the future. Grounding that movement and recognition in understanding, particularly of Indian people's unique and often violent relationship with the nation's past, provides potential hope.
We only have a minute left, and I'm going to throw you a curve. If we don't understand what the experience of Native Americans in this country, are we more likely to go along with something like George W. Bush's imperial wars in Iraq? I mean, is there some kind of parallel there?
I think there is. The plight of minority and indigenous peoples around the globe remains an ongoing tragedy, as well as unresolved problem. And if larger forms of consciousness and understanding can be brought to bear on recognizing these tragic and unresolved problems and redressing them, perhaps larger imperial projects won't be undertaken as often as they have been.
Well, we should hope that our knowledge will make us better citizens and less bloodthirsty ones, as we have right now in the White House. Ned Blackhawk, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
It's been an honor.
Ned Blackhawk's fascinating book, Violence Over the Land, Indians and Empires in the Early American West.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.